Thanks for pressing play and listening in to the Safety Podcast. We aim to break down the barriers to learning in the HSE space to help you stay motivated, improve your knowledge, and maximise your impact. So on the show today, we have an esteemed guest all the way from Scotland. Billy Sim is a veteran firefighter of over 30 years who, since retiring, has taken it upon himself to share what he has learned during his time in the fire service and try and translate it into something unique and useful via corporate training programs, which focuses on soft skills. Billy explains how he has extracted the key learning from his many years in the emergency services and try to simplify them into practical tools that can be used in any context to achieve better outcomes for people and businesses. If this sounds like something you would like to hear a little bit more about, stick around.
Welcome to the Safety Podcast with your host, all the way from a small green island in the wild Atlantic Ocean, Richard Collins.
Thanks for sticking around and joining me on this conversation with Billy Sim. I really hope you can take some value from this conversation. Let's go over and speak to him. Billy Sim, thank you very much for joining us on the Safety Podcast today, all the way from sunny East Kilbride in Scotland.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, Richard. Yes, I'm doing fine. It's glad to be here. Thank you.
We're obviously interested to hear what you have to say. You've lots of experience coming from many years in the fire service. And now, of course, you're working as part of Love Learning Scotland, delivering training. Can you tell us a little bit about your background just for the audience and sort of how you got here?
Yes, Richard. In my background, I had done 30 years in the fire service. Now, that was split up roughly 15 years on a frontline fire appliance. So I have a wealth of experience of attending emergency incidents as a firefighter and an officer as well. And then the last 15 years of my career, I was a senior officer, and I was predominantly involved in training and assessment, if you want. Now, within the fire service, we have what's called incident command. I was in charge of incident command. That involves helping firefighters and officers make risk-critical decisions. So I was heavily involved in this. I'd done a lot of work with the Scottish Fire Service College, and I represented the service at national level, where I was responsible for things like leadership, management, as well as the soft skills, what we call communication, situation awareness and decision making, because these are vitally important in the fire service, and I don't think a lot of people realise why. Now, one of the things that made these vitally important in the fire service was partly the Piper Alpha disaster. Are you aware of that, Richard? I take it, yeah.
Yes, I am indeed. I don't remember it as such, but not don't want to give away my age here, but obviously it was a massive disaster in the oil and gas industry, right?
Yeah, but one of the issues that came out of that, Richard, Lord Cullen looked into the Piper Alpha disaster, and one of the things he came out, one of his recommendations was, and it was to do with risk-critical decision-making. What he said was that conventional training was no good. I'm just paraphrasing here, but conventional training and assessment was no good if the person themselves cannot make risk-critical decisions in a time of extreme stress. So, yes. What he was saying, the incident, what happened was there were decisions made that it appeared the person was under so much stress that they couldn't make the decisions. Now, if you think in an emergency situation, firefighters are the same. We have to deal with emergency situations. But under the Health and Safety at Work Act, all fire authorities have to make sure people have got sufficient instruction, information, training and supervision. So we had to make sure firefighters and fire officers had this prerequisite amount of training. So we complied with the Health and Safety at Work Act, but so they could do the job to the standard that the public and we expect. So that was where my background came from, and that's how I learned the risk-critical decision-making. There was a lot of stuff done in Aberdeen, Robert Gordon University and Aberdeen University on this. And we got a lot of good information from them. And we worked closely with professors and psychologists to come up with a program to make sure that our personnel were trained as good as it could be. And it was based in good empirical evidence as well. So we had the psychology part of it. We had the professors and part of my job was get it to a language that firefighters could understand and they could use on the incident ground. So that was very important to me. And I've got a lot of background in relation to that.
Billy, it's something, as you say, you know, that I guess a lot of people listening who are involved in health and safety management and, you know, crisis management would not have direct training in terms of how to react under stress as such. We always talk about preparation for those moments, but we don't necessarily have the competence or experience in actually dealing with it when it does happen. And I have to say, it is something that that crosses my mind on occasion. You know, what would I do if this happens? So I can certainly see the value in it. Absolutely, from the fire services point of view. I take it now you've identified how this could be. I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but have you sort of identified why and how this could be useful in the corporate context?
Well, one of the things I looked at, Richard, when I could retire, I looked at, I've got a lot of skills. I believe I've got a lot of skills in this area. Now, one of the things I always say to firefighters and people who are ready to retire, we've got a lot of skills that are transferable. And I was looking to see how the skills and knowledge I had, how could I transfer this over to the private sector, if you want, because one of the key areas I looked at was decision making. I was involved heavily in decision making. Now, that's a key aspect of firefighting, but it's also a key aspect of everyday work. People have to make decisions. So I looked at all the reports I had and all the stuff I had from the professors, the psychologists, and I tried to come up with a process. I would like to come up with a three-step process, if you want, for people making decisions. But I didn't actually have enough evidence. Well, I didn't think I had enough evidence, but then I looked back and within the fire service, we have to keep things called incident logs. Now, when I go to an incident, there's a log of all the messages, and basically the messages are a log of the decisions I've made. Now, I was fortunate to have a log of every incident I went to as a senior officer. So I had probably over 1,000 messages that I could go through. Now, when I was going through them, Richard, what I was looking for is I was trying to look for key aspects of each incident. I was trying to break it down into three key parts. So we had recurring themes or recurring areas within every incident. And that's what I was looking at. So I went through and I managed to break it down into what I thought had three key areas. Then I went to look at historical incidents, not the ones I attended, but just any historical incident, and I broke them down into three key areas. And this is why I came up with this decision-making process. Now, to me, the decision-making process is very simple. I'll explain it hopefully very quickly. I'll not go into it in full detail because usually it takes a day to explain the whole process and do the whole course, but I'm trying to go into it very quickly. So when you're making any decision, Richard, the first thing you need to do is specify the expected outcomes. You need to concentrate and be outcome focused. Looking at these decisions, it would appear that everyone wasn't doing that. And sometimes people were making decisions that under no circumstances could get them to achieve the outcome. So the first thing I say when making any decision, specify the expected outcomes, because that's vitally important. And we teach people to do that within the program. The next thing we look at was identifying other factors and potential consequences. Some decisions we've seen within the fire service, the other factors and potential consequences were so glaring and so foreseeable that people shouldn't have made the decision in the first place. So we look at that. And the third thing we teach within this decision-making process is to maximise learned experience. In my opinion, Richard, learned experience is not used anywhere near enough within the context that I had worked, and it's the most undervalued commodity. And I'm just talking about getting knowledge or skill from doing, seeing or feeling things. That's how I class as learned experience. Now, I break these three areas down and I show people how to use them. But the other thing that I had to realise quite quickly, decision-making can't stand on its own. It has to be linked to situation awareness and communication. So I had to find ways of incorporating all this into a package that would help people in their jobs. Now, I'm not talking about emergency incidents. I'm talking about the work environment, the normal day-to-day work, the normal workload that people have to do, because I think these skills are key across every sector, and it doesn't just have to be in an emergency situation. So that's why I approached it the way I did, and that's why I broke it down the way I did. And it took quite a long time and a long process to get to this, but we are teaching it just now. People seem to understand it, and they are taking it on board.
It's absolutely fascinating to hear that you've obviously identified the fact that you have such amazing data there to be used, and have went and studied that data, and then taken as much useful information as possible from it, looked for the commonalities, and then boiled it down into something that can be used in the everyday context. It's pretty awesome that you've done that in the first place. As you say, there's probably a lot of guys out there, whether it be in the fire service or otherwise, doing, you know, we all become accustomed to doing our jobs every day, and maybe don't realize, for want of a better word, the sort of data that surrounds us and the information that's available to us that we can use to kind of improve things moving forward. So yes, you know, that is really fascinating. Just tracking back a second, just so that we understand, in terms of the specify expected outcomes, are you talking about whenever someone encounters a situation that they identify the outcomes that they want to happen, or are they identifying at that point the actual, you know, worst case scenario of what may happen?
No, at that point, the very first thing we try and teach is, when you make a decision, you specify what you want to achieve. You specify your key objectives or your key outcomes. Now, When we teach this, there's not usually just one outcome. We try and teach a number of outcomes, so you can look and you can go back and make sure you're actually achieving those outcomes. So it's the outcomes you want to achieve. That's it, before you even make a decision. Because believe it or not, Richard, it doesn't always happen.
That's absolutely clear now. Yep, I get you. I expected that may be the case. So you're trying to outline at a very high level what you want to achieve firstly, and then you move on to the factors, the influencing factors or the potential consequences then. So at that point, are you looking at what can happen here, worst case scenario, or what you're trying to prevent as a consequence, or can you give us an idea of what that might be?
Yes, Richard. One of the things, and I think one of the key analogies is this, is road traffic collisions. I'm involved in a charity. We do employability and we do stuff like that. And I speak a lot to young people, and I try and emphasise to them the dangers of young people driving too fast and what they do. Now, if you see, for example, a young person behind the wheel of a powerful car, his expected outcome might be totally different because he's not identified other factors, sort of thing. So he's not got the experience to drive possibly at the speed he's doing or stuff like that. So we try and say to him, when you're behind a car, you need to know what you want to do, because if you don't identify the other factors, or more importantly, potential consequences. The example I would give you, if you get a young driver in a car, they are 18, 19-year-old. They're going round a corner in the wrong side of the road and they're going too fast. The potential consequences to me and you are very foreseeable. We can see them. To a young person, they might not think of that and they might not even consider that. So they need to identify the other factors when they are behind the wheel of a car. So it's sort of things like that, Richard. And because I'm dealing with young people, they can totally relate to it once I start explaining it to them, because I hate to say it, but I can go into detail on the consequences of some of these. And this is one of the things I feel is very important, is people do things and don't look at the potential consequences. They don't even take them into account.
Yeah, I really understand that. I mean, obviously, growing up and, you know, the example of young people driving, very close to home. I think most of us listening, most of the people listening today will probably know of someone that's been in a serious road accident, especially, you know, younger people. Obviously, there's a long history of that. And as a parent now, it's something that's very much something I really think about. I have a couple of young kids, and, you know, I'm already starting to think about how I'm going to manage that. And maybe because I work in health and safety, it's more in my conscience. Obviously, you have lots of experience. You've seen the, you know, the difficult end of it when things go wrong, Billy. So we'll not go into the detail on that. I'm sure we can all imagine what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, you could imagine, Richard, you could imagine the talk I had to my 18-year-old son when he passed his test. Let's just leave it at that, yes.
I can indeed. I'm sure it's at home all right now. And so that's fine. So you're thinking about the potential consequences. In the context of this, Billy, so whenever you're thinking about this decision-making process, are you generally thinking about someone who is, I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes, Are you trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's conducting an activity just more generally, rather than, for some reason in my head, I had sort of a first responder type person? I think I've got that wrong, haven't I?
Yes, no, Richard. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say that if we set up this process, you can use it for any decision you make. So it doesn't matter what it is. If you... It could be any example. Before you make a decision, what are you trying to achieve? What are the other factors? What are the potential consequences? And then the third part is maximising learned experience. What experience do you have in that arena? Have you done it before? Are you skilled in doing what you're doing? Can you use the experience of others? So this is all the tools we teach, and we show people how to do this. And we do it by... We look at historical examples, we look at historical incidents, and we break this down and we put the three-step process into it. And then people understand it a bit better, because then you can explain in detail, well, they expected to do that, but the potential consequences were so grave that you wouldn't even consider that. So we put things like that into perspective and try and fit it in that way, Richard.
You are talking about how this then applies to stress in the workplace, and how stress, reducing stress can then also reduce accidents. Can you tell us a little bit about how that actually relates and how you picked up on why that would be valuable? Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah. No. Well, Richard, what I'd done when I came out with this process, now I was looking initially to use decision making to help companies, to help companies make better decisions, but to communicate better and have better situation awareness. So within Love Learning Scotland, we have a course just now, which is we use situation awareness and soft skills to prevent workplace accidents. You'll be aware most accidents are caused by human error. Human error, for want of a better word, is people making bad decisions. So we try and train people to make better decisions to stop workplace accidents. Now, it may sound overly simplistic, but that's the way I see it. If people are making bad decisions and causing accidents, if we can teach them this process to make better decisions, it should stop accidents or reduce accidents. So that was my initial approach to this. Now, people within Love Learning, I also thought these processes would be good for the work environment. If people communicate better, if they have better situation awareness, and if they make better decisions. So I'd started training the staff within Love Learning Scotland and then started talking about it. And as I got down and I started getting into detail, the amount of people that said that they remember working in other employers and some of the decisions that were made was and the stress it caused within the workforce. So they started to get into great detail, and some cited examples of people leaving the job because of the stress and because of what was happening, and getting offered another job or getting offered to come back, and they wouldn't even go back for more money because of the stress. And I thought, I think I'm approaching this from a different angle. I shouldn't be looking to put this in for financial benefit of the companies. I need to look at workplace stress, because in my opinion, and I can speak from experience here in the fire service, a lot of workplace stress is caused by poor decisions, poor situation awareness. and poor communications as well. So that's the three areas that I believe causes workplace stress. But when I listened to the people in Love Learning Scotland and what they were saying, they had experienced this in the previous employment as well. And the lack of these skills in the workplace is a major cause of workplace stress. So I started carrying out research, and there's a lot of figures out there to support this. There was a survey done, and it was between United Kingdom and the US workers. 40% said the main cause of workplace stress in their organisations is poor communication. Now, this is the evidence that I'm finding. So why don't we teach people to communicate better?
Yeah, I know. It seems very obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something, I don't know if you've come up against this, but I had a guy on a show recently who has the sort of IOSH coaching for safety course that he delivers. Michael Emery is his name, and he was saying that he has had quite a lot of difficulty, although now he's getting traction. But in the early stages, from about 5 years ago when he introduced coaching for safety, so it's all about, you know, giving people ownership in the decision making process as well. He found that the profession in itself, in terms of health and safety, just didn't value soft skills, and just, you know, they don't see it maybe or didn't see it as tangible, and maybe that's a similar thing that you're seeing.
Well, and when I approached this, now, I was originally trying to teach people to make better decisions so the decision-making process would end up being more profitable for the company. But I have found it was almost like a eureka moment for me, Richard, because I've been approaching this all wrong. I shouldn't be looking at getting them to make better decisions to improve the finances. The main cause, the main problem in the workforce just now is workplace stress. Now, I don't know if you know some of the figures are absolutely horrendous. I think it was 595,000 workers are suffering from stress, anxiety and depression. Now, this is up almost 250,000 from last year, so that's a huge amount. Now, I'd looked back in my career in the fire service. Now, I worked for an emergency service. We've seen some traumatic events. In all my career in the fire service, I cannot remember anyone booking off or going sick with workplace stress due to what they've seen at an emergency situation. Every time I know anyone who's off in workplace stress, it was a non-emergency situation. It was to do with the workplace. It was to do with, as I say, poor communications, poor situation awareness, and poor decision-making. All these were the key factors. So because of the skills I have, I'm trying to use these skills to teach these key areas, because I think this is the best approach in looking at workplace stress. I think this is the best way to go about it. Now, one of the things that I'm really conscious of, at this point in time, we look at workplace stress and we try and put things in to manage it. We try and put, if you want, well-being programs in and mindfulness programs and all this. But workplace stress is a hazard. If it's a hazard, if we look at the hierarchy of controls for a hazard, the best thing is elimination. Why don't we go to eliminate workplace stress? We concentrate on what's causing it. If poor communications is causing workplace stress, let's improve communications and reduce it. If poor situation awareness is causing workplace stress, give people an appreciation of what's happening around them and how their actions and inactions can affect it. And if poor decision making is causing it, show people a simple three-step process, how they can apply it to any decisions and help improve workplace stress. So that's basically my approach to it, Richard. And I know it looks quite simplistic, but I believe that the simplest solutions are usually the best.
Yes, Billy, I would definitely agree with you there in regards to simplification being a massive benefit when trying to communicate these types of things. So we've got the three elements. I'm sure most of the audience will be familiar with the terms communication skills and decision making. The term situational awareness maybe isn't just as common. Can you give us a little bit more of an explanation as to what that means for you?
Yeah, Richard, because I came from an emergency, I was taught this from an emergency services background. And what I have done is I've looked at, some people break down situation awareness. It's about perception, comprehension and projection, right? But I just try and keep it simple, because when you explain it simply, people understand. It's a person's awareness of what's happening around them and how their actions and sometimes their inactions can influence this. Now, this does not have to be an emergency situation. This can be a non-emergency situation. I've seen people with extremely poor situation awareness almost cause carnage because they don't know what they are, that they are unaware of what's happening around them. So situation awareness is just important, just as important in an emergency situation as a non-emergency situation. And we try and teach this, and we use tools so people can understand this. We use good practical examples. And as soon as we start training it, people go, oh yes, I see what you mean. So people can relate to it because we put it across very simply and in practical terms. And I think that's the key to this.
Okay. You were mentioning there somebody who had discussed the just earlier this week the key factors in reducing workplace stress, and you touched on obviously getting to the root cause and the hierarchy of control, which of course many people will relate to and understand. I see what you're saying there. We aren't tackling the true reasons why people are stressed in the first place, because obviously that would mean questioning what the organisations are doing, which is the more difficult question, rather than putting in place management programs and so on to actually try and administrate the stress as such.
Yes.
Which is not what we want to do. So I completely understand that. I think it's definitely the right approach. We talk about stress causing obviously huge amount of days away from work, and mental health is obviously very much on the agenda at the moment. But there isn't much talk, from what I can see, in terms of how that stress actually leads to accidents and the interrelationship between those two. Is that something that you're trying to sort of highlight?
Yes, we're looking at that as well, Richard, because it's not just absenteeism that causes, that is a great issue here. Sometimes presenteeism, where people go to work and they're under stress and they're not fully concentrating. So a lot of the time, this has a contributory factor to accidents as well. So we're trying to look at the whole lot of it, and we're trying to look at how what we can do to help people realise that if they improve in these, what I see as these three key areas, they will greatly reduce the instances of workplace stress. And if we reduce workplace stress, a lot of accidents are caused by stress, as you know, as well, and people are under pressure. And this is why we are taking this approach. This is why we're going down this way.
I'm very much someone who, like yourself, values the soft skills side of this and feels that there is much more room for improvement, and hence why we're talking about this today. Much of the difficulty, of course, is trying to communicate this to senior levels of organizations and so on. Can you give us any idea as to how you try and validate or justify this type of approach?
Yeah, well, to put it in the simplest way possible, Richard, see, if you don't train someone how to do something, how are they meant to know how to do it? It really is, sometimes it is that simple. But what we want to do is we want to get involved in organisations because we believe this approach is almost a spend to save strategy. With the money you invest in this training, to give you a bit of background, I mentioned Love Learning. Love Learning is a charity. We are set up as a charity, so see any funds we get for corporate training, we feed this back into our organisation to try and help the most disadvantaged within our community. So we feed this in to our organisation to help the community. So it gives companies, it gives them a bit of corporate social responsibility as well. So if they take on our training, but what we're keen to go into an organisation and have a benchmark. Here's what your levels are. Here's what the, if you want, here's what your sickness level is. Here's what the workplace stress is. Here's the bottom line. we want to go in and we want to improve that by doing the training that we know makes a difference. I know this makes a difference. I know training people to communicate better will help prevent workplace stress. So we want to go in there, work with these companies. What I would say as well, we're talking about almost any sector we go in, we can go into. I'm not going in there as a subject expert on their sector. I'm going in there as giving them the tools and techniques that we think they need within their sector. They have the learned experience within their sector, Richard, and I cannot take that away from them. But I hope to use their learned experience to help prevent, help them communicate better, help them make better decisions, and help them have better situation awareness. So that is my whole approach to this.
Can you give us any examples of practical examples of what good practice might look like?
Well, one of the things I look at is communication. Now, we try and teach communication at its simplest level as getting the right information to the right people at the right time using the most appropriate communications medium. Now, one of the things I've seen today, and I think it was, I don't know whether it was at NHS, but they're looking to use almost Skype and things like that for patients. They're looking to use that. Now, we would break that down and say, is the right information getting to the right people? Yeah. Is it getting at the right time? Yeah. Is it now the most appropriate communications medium? Yes, it might be. So we would put that onto organisations and we would say to them, here's what we're teaching. Give me an example where that would fit into your organisation. So we're using our tools, our techniques, but giving them with the learned experience and letting them fit it into what they're trying to achieve.
I can certainly relate to times whenever the wrong communication method has been used to pass a message on. And in terms of sort of causes of stress, would you say that poor communication methods such as using emails instead of one-to-one, for example, is actually a cause of relationship breakdowns and so on?
We give that as an example, Richard. When we do this this topic, we go into detail. We give maybe a couple of scenarios and we get people to identify what would the best communications medium be then. And we show them the practicalities of good and bad communications. So we give them practical examples. We use a number of we get them to do a number of scenarios as well. So they take part in it and then they realise what bad communications is because they realise what the pitfalls are. So we get them to do it themselves and it comes across very well because it reinforces the learning. And I think that's what it's all about. But if you can do that practically, that they can all understand, that's the way we go about it, Richard. And it seems to be very well received.
I can really see the value in that, to be honest. It's not something, of course, that many organisations or people within organisations will even recognise as a problem. And that in itself is the problem, I guess. But I suppose it's getting that level of awareness and self-awareness to the people and showing them where they may be contributing towards stress.
One of the things we're trying to get across, Richard, I do not think I have worked in any organisation, or you as well, we would not have people in there and managers who would go in there with the sole purpose of giving people workplace stress. That is never, I wouldn't think that was ever their intention. But sometimes it's a byproduct of poor communications, poor decision making and poor situation awareness. So let's train these people because their perception may be that what they're doing is fine. However, that might not be the case, and we need to get people to almost shift their perception, make sure their perception is the same as what the way they see it is the same as the world sees it as well. So that's why this is not you're not doing this right. This is hopefully giving people the tools and the training so they can do it a bit better, so they've got a better understanding of it, and so they can see the consequences of, if you want, their actions and inactions. So that's why we go down this approach, because we believe people genuinely want to do what's best for themselves, the company, the organisation. And all we're trying to do is give them the tools and the skills to be able to do that.
I think this is really valuable, Billy, and thanks for coming on to discuss your approach with us today. Soft skills is something I brought up in a number of discussions online on podcasts and social media and so on, there are a number of people out there who seem to have the perception that soft skills can't be taught. Do you have an opinion on that one?
No, they, trust me, Richard, they definitely can. I have done it. I have shown people. I do practical scenarios. I do it in communication. I do it in situation awareness. And I do it in decision making. All these are classed as soft skills, and you can, everything can be trained, in my opinion. People can be trained if you give them simple tools, simple techniques, and you explain it in a practical, I think that's the key as well, Richard. You have to put it in a practical method that they can take on board right away. If you give them the practical examples, here's what happens if, but here's how it could go if you go down this route. They take it on board. People want to learn, but they need to have it in a language and a format that they understand. And that's what we're all about. That's what we're trying to achieve.
I really want to come on and do your training now. So I'm going to have to see if I can get some flights booked to Glasgow.
No, Richard, I can come over there. It's not an issue. We can travel. It's not a problem.
No worries. Can you just let the audience know, Billy, where we can find more information about what you're doing there, if you would?
Yeah, I work for a company. I've got my own company, but I prefer doing work through the charity, and that is Love Learning Scotland. Now, we do corporate training. We are heavily involved in early years training, but we're also involved in stress management as well. So Love Learning Scotland, we do corporate training and we do all this. And it's basically everything gets fed back in to help the most disadvantaged or the furthest removed from the community. So it helps if companies are interested. It helps them demonstrate corporate social responsibility. But the other advantage we have, we can access funding from Skills Development Scotland. So some of the courses that we're talking about, if you are in Scotland, there may be funding for these courses for your personnel. So it can be a win-win situation. If we can secure funding, you can get these courses. Thanks to this lovely country I live in, Skills Development Scotland support this, and they support people getting developed and trained. So, but the company is Love Learning Scotland. We are increasing our corporate training. We're hoping to increase our premises as well. And we really hope that this new approach gets people thinking, because I really believe that it will make a difference, Richard. I really do.
Well, Eric, thank you again for coming on to the Safety Podcast. I've been really interested to hear what you've had to say today, Billy. Thanks for bringing your experience, your knowledge, and making the decision to share it with people. Take my hat off to you for that. Hopefully this information that you've shared, you know, will get out to people in Scotland and beyond. And, you know,
fingers crossed,
you can move things forward from here. So thank you again, and we'll leave some information and resources for people, show them where to find you and so on in the show notes. So take care of yourself, Billy, and maybe we'll catch up again in the future.
That's great, Richard. Thanks very much.
Wow, what a nice guy. I don't know about you, but I found that a really interesting call. And as someone who's involved in crisis management, I found it interesting to hear the views of another person who has lots of experience in critical situations within the fire service. I think it's important for us to appreciate the emphasis that someone like Billy is putting on, putting toward non-technical soft skills. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, so please drop me a comment on LinkedIn. I'll put a post on after this is released and let me know what you think. I look forward to starting a conversation with you. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for joining me. If you haven't already done so, please take a second if you can to join our community at safetypodcast.com to help influence our future direction. You can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Google Podcasts. If you can, I'd really appreciate it if you can leave us a quick, honest review. So until next time, keep stepping out of your comfort zone, keep making a positive impact on health, safety, and the environment, and hopefully we'll catch you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Safety Podcast. We would love you to tell us which episode you would like to hear. Don't forget to give us a shout at safetypodcast.com.